This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and tonight I'm joined again by Don Orth, who's sitting in for Bradley for another week. This show has two sponsors. Our first sponsor is our friends at Tap Typing. Tap Typing is an app that teaches students how to type properly on the iPad. To learn more, go to gettaptyping.com or search for typing on the App Store, and it's the first result there. Our second sponsor, we'll tell you a little bit about later on, is Silent Light, which is an iOS app that helps you manage the volume levels in your classroom. Good evening, Don. How are you?
I'm good. Doing well here. How are you?
Excellent. I'm pretty good, too. We've had pretty much three unbroken weeks of fantastic weather. I'm podcasting from an undisclosed holiday location this week.
Nice. Is it in like the Maldives or...
I wish it was that far away.
You're getting good weather.
Well, actually, I just heard before we came on air here that in Greenock today, back home, there was a lightning storm that set fire to a building not too far from my house.
Wow.
Full blaze and everything. So that's not something that happens every day in Greenock.
Well, that's a good chance to redesign or rebuild anyway.
Yeah, I think they're going to have a full opportunity for that.
Nice.
Grand. Good. Tonight's topic, Don, we sort of trailed it a couple of weeks ago when you were on the show filling in for Bradley before. We were thinking about talking digital citizenship.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I would say, there's lots of debate now just about calling it digital citizenship in the first place. I think the idea initially was to get people thinking about it because there's all sorts of, the kind of stereotypical cyberbullying and these dangerous behaviors that were happening online and causing... pretty drastic effects on kids' lives. But really, what we see digital citizenship as here, and I think it's becoming more and more common, is just what is good citizenship in general, and how does it extend kind of to your online digital life?
Okay. So the first thing to sort of talk about is how do you define citizenship? Where do we go with that?
That's a good question. Just be nice. Just be nice to people. Walk around in the world and be good and contribute. Right. I mean, I think it's as simple as that at its most basic. I mean, if we think about the children we're helping grow and we're teaching, what kind of people do we want them to be? Mm-hmm. If you could create a person and build them over time, what kind of people do you want in the world? And I think that's where we start kind of defining good citizenship. So certainly people who are kind, who are generous, who are empathetic, who are thoughtful to others, who exercise good judgment, who are thoughtful. So I think those are some good characteristics that I'd want in our future people. Okay. And even now it would be nice.
I wonder if there's a kind of interesting difference between your side of the Atlantic and mine, in that you have a written Bill of Rights and a constitution and various things like that that guarantee citizens certain things, whereas in the UK, we don't really have those things written down. They're kind of made up for us by a combination of the BBC and some crusty old people that work at Oxford University.
That's right. Citizenship is defined by media. I love it. That's good. So what does the BBC tell you have to be like to be a good citizen?
Well, I don't know. It comes and goes with the weather, but I think it mostly involves supporting England at cricket, which is a sport I know nothing about.
Well, you are a terrible citizen then. I mean, I'm surprised you haven't been exported yet.
Yeah, well, it could be worse things than that.
I think so, perhaps. what do you think, though? I mean, I'm curious about kind of your sense of, I imagine it's the same. I mean, human beings are human beings, right? I mean, cricket aside, what is it like? What are the characteristics that you want in your students at your school?
Well, it was interesting because I started thinking about this in terms of, I was reading a lot of material recently about, the sort of problems with jobs in the digital economy and things like that. And, thinking about the American dream as constituted, and then I just thought, well, what is the British version of the American dream? And in the political narrative, it's always basically people who follow the rules and work hard to get on in life kind of thing. And at the same time, I was thinking, well, there's that part of, you know, what we think of as the model citizen. And then at the same time, our politicians are asking us to generate more and more creativity in the classroom.
Sure.
I wondered, you know, how much of those are those two things in tension? You know, our citizens are people who work hard and follow the rules, yet we want people to be creative. And creative people tend not to be the kind of people who follow the rules.
I love it. I love that juxtaposition. Yeah, no, it's interesting because you don't necessarily, I mean, I think, you know, the best, most brilliant creative people work extremely hard, right? Mm. And are disciplined and find ways to build creativity in their lives. I think, you know, obviously it's great to have that spark and to be spontaneous, but I think really to create and to kind of leverage your creativity and imagination, you need to be disciplined. So probably initially it feels like they clash, but I imagine those really creative spirits that are building and inventing are just as disciplined as that kind of 9-to-5 kind of worker who goes, sits at the desk and comes back. Maybe they're more so, you know?
I think certainly for those who make a career out of it and a lifetime out of it, that's probably certainly very true. But for those who sort of live hard and die young, you know, I don't think we're trying to build students who die young, of course, but you know, some of the brightest stars in some ways have not been as long lasting as others who have been a bit more disciplined about it.
Yeah.
Apart from Keith Richards, of course, who seems to be unkillable despite his own best efforts.
Yeah. Well, I wonder also, you know, what you said about breaking the rules. How, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, all the cliches out there, you know, you need to know the rules to break the rules, kind of thing. And that breaking the rules is kind of the next evolutionary step, right? To know, I mean, you look at great artists like Picasso, you know, amazing artists could replicate anything in the world. And yet, you know, his final days were spent pretty abstract and, you know, out there. So, but was a brilliant, you know, brilliant all the way around. So the breaking the rules thing is interesting and I think relevant to our conversation here because in some ways we want people to follow the rules. On the other hand, there's that culture that says you need to break them to really break out of the mold and invent and change the world.
Yeah, and in some ways both of our cultures sort of celebrate those iconoclasts rather than the people who sort of in a disciplined fashion just execute over and over again.
Yeah. What do you think about that? I'm really interested. You got my interest here. I mean, what are we trying to do?
I have no clue. I think, you know, in some ways, I look at a lot of the materials that are produced around digital citizenship, and in some ways, I feel like they're kind of built to produce the least amount of drama. You know, if you do these things, we'll all get along and everything will be calm and quiet. And if we all just sort of agree, that'll be fine, you know. Whereas in some ways you might want to actually generate more debate and more discussion around these things.
Well, sure. And I think, you know, going back to the digital citizenship piece, you know, I think a lot of schools, and I think it's changing, a lot of schools talk about, you know, locking things down, you know, making a safe environment for kids and kind of disabling the ability to make mistakes, you know, heavy web filtering, only giving certain apps. I mean, the whole iPad story is so interesting because you have all these kind of traditional schools who are trying to lock down iPads, and it's just not designed for that, right? I mean, you could do it, but it takes away a lot of the fun.
It does, for sure. And I think... I mean, I've seen some amazing things being done with iPads in schools. You know, I went to one school a couple of years back where they had jailbroken all their iPads and made it so that you had to put in a password to launch any new app. I don't know even know how they did that or why. But, I mean, that's the extent I've seen some people go to try and kind of keep control of these things. And it's definitely a challenge. It's a cultural challenge, right? It's not really a technical challenge in that sense.
You know, I think it's a great analogy, you know, the whole iPad lockdown debate and, you know, very related to the whole digital citizenship approach. You know, as a school, do we want to create those rubber rooms, You know, do we want to create the padded rooms where students are safe? And it's funny because there's all this talk of failure, how failure is brilliant and taking risks is great. And yet, on the other side, there's the idea that we need to create safe environments where kids can't get hurt. And that's socially and psychologically as well as obviously physically. You know, you have the rubber stuff around the playground, which isn't a bad idea. And then you have this whole, you know, the whole internet, the World Wide Web out there that is full of trouble and pitfalls and dark alleys and streets and amazing, wonderful, bright, creative places. So how do you approach that? And I think it's still is raging debate about what we do as schools. What's our responsibility?
Yeah, and I think in some ways the digital citizenship agenda has kind of risen up alongside a recognition that basically control has failed, right? Hmm. And not just in control in terms of like filtering in school, although that seems to be reasonably breakable for most children of any kind of technical competence. They seem to get around it quite easily. But, you know, I've got a pal who teaches in a school in England, and he told me a story of five boys that he found about in his school who they'd sort of put their pocket money together and they'd bought themselves a MiFi hotspot, and they were taking their school iPads and they were connecting them to this other network that was just roaming around the school with them.
That's great.
And they had collaborated in that. And also just, you know, the number of kids bringing smartphones to school now as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's the ubiquity of devices now that we can't control. And so that's a wake up call, right? I mean, okay, so now we can't control the devices. It's not just about, you know, building tunnels in the firewall. It's we can't even control the devices. So, knowing that, and it's probably a good thing, and that's certainly where we're going. How do we educate our kids? How do we help them navigate the world? You know, in the same way, you know, you teach a kid how to look both ways. You know, you hold their hand a little when they're crossing the street. You teach them to look both ways. You're kind of repeating that message over and over again, and eventually they got to walk on their own, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly in the same way, you have young kids. Obviously, when they're little, you know, you're going to be with them when they're using computers and they're on the internet. But eventually, we're not going to be there by their side all the time, and so they need some tools that they've internalized. You know, how do I think about this? How do I approach this? What are my checks and balances? That's absolutely a school's responsibility. It's absolutely a parent's responsibility. And the interesting piece is that I think it's fallen in kind of the gap between school and home. Schools think that parents should be responsible. And this is not, you know, this is a generalization, certainly not always the case, but I think there's some of this. Is it the parents' responsibility to educate their kids? Parents probably are, in my experience, don't have a whole lot of experience, most of them, and so feel like it's the school's job because the school's introducing technology to kids. And so often it gets lost in that shuffle.
Yeah, I agree. It seems to happen more often than not that's the way it goes. That sometimes there's a sort of a group of people who, you know, you might call them, I don't know, cyber libertarians or something, where they're kind of like, well, individual responsibility is the way to go. And certainly, I mean, there's been a debate this week in the UK about the government proposing the idea of opt-in filtering for, or opt-out filtering for porn on the internet, where every home broadband connection will have some kind of filter on it, and you have to tick a box to say you don't want to be filtered.
Interesting.
It's been really interesting to me because a lot of people who I know who you might say were all kind of on the left of politics have suddenly become libertarians overnight. You know, and they're like, well, you know, people should take their own responsibility and parents should do this and the government should have no role in that. But they want the government to have a role in, you know, education itself. They want the government to have a role in healthcare and all these different kinds of things.
Yeah.
But not in my internet connection.
You know, interesting. A lot of double standards.
Yeah. It's a real challenge. And I think, obviously, schools have kind of gone a lot further towards taking responsibility for things like filtering their internet. And sometimes filtering the internet in place of doing the education part. You know, that was...
Right.
In the first generation, that was kind of the way that schools handled the problem of the internet, was just to get rid of most of it.
Right. And I think that's still the case. I think the general school population, I think, is more about filtering pretty heavily because you can do it. You know, you buy a box, you check the boxes off, and you can filter. And, okay, so, you know, block some legitimate content. But I think in general, there's a tendency to say, well, we've done our best, and then, you know, and the rest, well, we can't control. But I think it's – I hate to say it. I think it's kind of a lazy approach. And sort of irresponsible, because the truth is, like I said, you know, the ubiquity of access right now. How do kids learn? You know, who is teaching them how to navigate, how to exercise good judgment?
Yeah, and if you never have any incidents, then you never have that conversation.
Right. You
know? It's, I mean, right. I always kind of go back to the analogy of like safety culture in things like aviation and railway safety and so on, which is something I kind of researched many, many years ago in a former life. But, you know, in transportation safety, the old-fashioned approach used to be just to blame the driver, right? You know, if a train crashes like it did in Spain this week, you just say, well, the driver was going too fast. That's it. But then, you know, newer theories come out and they say, well, why was he driving too fast? Was he under pressure because of the timetable? You know, and starting to work back and work back from just blaming the guy at the front lines. And one of the ways that you do that and get the information to make that happen is to have what they call no blame or justifiable blame reporting systems, where you can say, well, this thing happened, right? Let's all look into it together. You know, whether it is, you know, I went through a red light and I didn't hit any train, but we should talk about the reasons why I went through a red light, that kind of thing. So that's always kind of the way that I've tried to bring it in school, is to say, well, okay, if something happens, if something comes up that's not really okay, we should have a conversation about that and kind of openly conversation about it as well.
Right. And that's education, right? It's not, you know, even just saying no, bad. That's not really education. That's conditioning. And that's not nearly as effective or sustainable. Maybe it is. I mean, Pavlov says it is, and so maybe it is. But honestly, I think, you know, we do a service to the future, you know, by really helping kids understand. I think it's just like good parenting. You know, do you just simply say no, or do you say and talk about, you know, what was your thought process behind this? Why, and why is this? And then discuss. So, yeah, I think that approach is great. Help them process through. And then if they understand, you know, as any of us, when we understand something really well, we can apply that to a range of examples, not just purely that specific instance.
Yeah, so generalize your learning.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me just take a break and we'll talk about our first sponsor. Bradley's here virtually again to talk about it.
Hey, everybody, it's Bradley. I want to thank Fraser and the many co-hosts we'll have over the next few weeks while I'm out on paternity leave. But while I'm here, I want to talk to you about a great application called Tap Typing. Tap Typing is an app that teaches students how to type properly on the iPad. It has a structured curriculum with lessons ranging from beginner to advanced, a typing test for gauging improvement, and in addition to the built-in virtual keyboard, it has support for all types of external keyboards or cases. Tap Typing is appropriate for all ages and supports multiple user profiles, which is extremely handy for CART-based classroom environments. After just 3 sessions in Tap Typing, beginners increase their typing speeds by over 60% on average. This minimal time investment yields a permanent boost to productivity and soothes one of the most painful aspects of the iPad user experience: typing. I personally, at our school, we own over 40 copies of Tap Typing, and I'll be using it, you know, quite a bit this year. I'll probably be adding another 40 here soon. So this is one of those times where I've really put my money where my mouth is with our sponsors. Is this something that we use? And I've used since I heard about it a few years ago when they advertised on the 5x5 network. Our teachers love it. Our students love it. Our technology teacher, when I showed it to her, said this is really what we've been needing to take our iPad productivity to the next level. Again, by the end of the summer, I will own 80 copies of this app for our school. So to learn more about it, go to gettaptyping.com. Again, that's gettaptyping.com, gettaptyping.com, or just search for typing on the App Store. It's the very first result. Again, thanks for the folks at Tap Typing for sponsoring the show this week. So I highly encourage you check it out. Thanks, and we'll see you guys in a few weeks.
Don, from your point of view, what would you say are the core topics in digital citizenship?
Sure. So I think there's a lot of ways to break it down. And right now I've got Common Sense Media's site up, commonsensemedia.org. We've done a bunch of work with them, and I like how they've broken it down. I would say when I think about it outside their categories, so I can read off their categories right now, and then I can tell you what are the things that I really think that we are focusing on. They talk about internet safety, privacy and security, relationships and communication, cyberbullying, digital footprint and reputation, self-image and identity, information literacy, and creative credit and copyright.
Okay.
So they've broken it down nicely in kind of in eight blocks, and I think it's, you know, an effective way. What I see is one of the most important topics just that I've seen across the board is just communication. Mm-hmm. There's been a decline in good communication, I think, through digital means, and folks are just, I think, starting to understand, you know, how do I communicate well, how do I empathize towards the listener, especially kids, you know, when mm-hmm. So our kids get iPads, get their own iPad in fifth grade, so they are 11. And the first thing they do is explore all the ways to communicate with each other. You know, they're trying iMessaging, they're trying, you know, email, they're FaceTiming, they're doing all these things, and they're doing it well and they're doing it badly, but they're experimenting and trying to learn. But it's just interesting to see the evolution of their understanding and the mistakes they make.
Mm-hmm.
What I tell them is, you know, chances are, you know, if you're writing an email or a chat, chances are you're going to be misinterpreted. It's very likely that somebody is not going to understand exactly what you meant. Is, you know, you're not going to hear your tone, not going to make eye contact, not, will not get the message as they would in person. So to me, and then you also look at our younger grades. You know, they're using blogs a little bit. They're using something like Today's Meet, where you have kind of a public forum for digital feedback. There's so many ways that digital communication is part of education now that I feel like if they can learn that, if they can really understand good ways to communicate and good processes, we're doing them a service. So to me, that's an important focus.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And I think one of the very important things that you have to bring out in that kind of teaching is, why is it that you're misinterpreted? Because nobody really gets mm-hmm. that without being told.
Right.
You know, it's the fact that you can't see the person's face. It's all these things that we've picked up since birth, and then almost all of them are cut off to us when we communicate digitally.
Yeah.
But people don't even know that they've lost them because they never knew they had them in the first place.
Well, and I think kids too are very, you know, in the best ways, you know, they're egotistical, right? They're self-centered, mm-hmm. not in a negative way, but they are. That's the world revolves around you when you're young.
Mm-hmm.
And so your understanding of the world or the way you communicate, you assume that everyone else understands it the same way. And so without getting that feedback, like you said, the eye contact, the body language, all of those things that we take subconsciously, there's no way to tell. And so so one of the great exercises that I loved our fifth grade teachers did last year is we do with fifth grade, it'll probably be a 2-week kind of over 2 weeks digital citizenship kind of workshop over several days and kind of talking about some of these things. One of the skit that the two teachers did was an email skit, basically. They each had an iPad. They kind of did this little thing where one teacher took a picture of something, shared it with the other teacher, and said, "Isn't this great? This is, you know, my favorite thing in my room." The other teacher took that and said, "Cool," and shared it with everyone in the class, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they had this debate, but the interesting thing about the process is that the students saw this email communication as being from a human to a human, mm-hmm. right? They saw the facial expressions as they were typing. They heard the tone because they were reading them out as they typed. So it kind of brought alive what is normally kind of a two-dimensional conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it stuck. So does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you see what's there with the person and then
without. You're seeing what's on the other end of the keyboard. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so easy to forget when you're, you know, especially when you're emotional or you're you want to share something, you forget that the other person is there and has a life and is going to interpret this differently. So
definitely, yeah. Other topics in sort of digital citizenship, I think one that always sticks out to me a little bit, I'm not always that sure about its place in this kind of set of topics, is the issue of basically copyright respect and violation of copyright. And I wonder, do you think, I'm not sure what I think myself, but sometimes I kind of see these things put in as part of digital citizenship just because the consequences of youthful indiscretions in that area can be so vast now with the kind of penalties that are put in place. Do you see that as being a thing?
Yeah, so kind of copyright issues. I feel like those are, you know, for kids, those kind of issues are less, well, sure. Okay, so for instance, you know, cheating on a test or plagiarizing, certainly kids have been kicked out of school for that. But that's always been the case, right? I mean, yeah. I don't think that's any different now than it has ever been. I think it's always been serious. I think it's probably more lax now because adults are, you know, indiscreet about how we use sources, right? I mean, like we're probably the worst offenders. And so, you know, if anything, that has gotten, that kind of stringency has slacked off. So I don't know if that makes, if that answers the question.
We had an interesting situation with plagiarism a while back where a student handed in a piece of work that she had done, and it looked like a lot of it came from Wikipedia. So the teacher looked it up sure enough, a lot of it was from Wikipedia. So we had a conversation with the student and with their parents and so on, and they said, no, look, we took her, you know, the parents said, we took her to the museum and we took all these notes from the exhibits in the museum and all this kind of stuff. So the teacher actually went to the museum and had a look at it, and it turned out that a lot of the museum cards came from Wikipedia as well. So the student had sort of inadvertently plagiarized Wikipedia by doing the actual, you know, what she thought was genuine research in the museum.
That's perfect. It's perfect. Exactly.
The adult world is a terrible model for what we think.
It's terrible. You know?
Yeah,
I mean, not to go to that museum.
Yeah.
So, but I think, you know, that, you know, we're in, I think, one extreme right now, but I think it's coming back. You know, you look at iTunes U and it makes when you post something, it makes you choose the type of copyright, you know, is it Creative Commons? Is it all rights reserved? So, I mean, tools like that make you think certainly about, what you're using, is what you're using original or not. Certainly when I created an iTunes U course, I'm always thinking, you know, wow, I really need to be careful about everything I put in here because I've been asked explicitly to indicate what this is. So maybe it's a matter of building that more in to the adult world as well. I don't know. You know, you also think of teachers building those building books, you know, resource books. Mm-hmm. Those are always copies of articles and copies of different things. So what does that mean?
Yeah, and I think that's certainly something that I've had to emphasize to people as they've been building iTunes U courses at our school, to say, look, be absolutely scrupulous with this, because if you ever come to me and say, I want this to go on the public site, I'm going to go through this and I'm going to ask you for the provenance of every piece of media in this course. And that's not something I've ever done for teachers before, you know, for materials that are just in the school. That's kind of up to them what they do with it, you know. But even teaching teachers about Creative Commons is, never mind teaching pupils about it, it's something that's kind of new to us as well.
Yeah, and important. And I think that's becoming more and more a part of, you know, certainly for Hillbrook, the digital citizenship piece, it's one of our priorities next year, and bringing that in from grade one, from when they're little, you know, from when they're 5 years old, having a component of kind of education around your digital life and things like copyright and internet safety. We're going to, you know, that will be scaffolded all the way through. So, but teachers will have to understand that more, because they'll be teaching it and it'll be, you know, part of the everyday.
Absolutely.
And I think that as schools, it's the only way we can be effective. It can't be a single resource teacher talking about these things. It's got to be every teacher understanding these concepts and helping students kind of as things come up through.
Yeah, because I think over the course of the school year, different situations arise. You know, sometimes, I mean, there's always been the bit about plagiarizing text for an essay, but then how does that flow into things like a sound effect for a video that we're doing, or you know, an original piece of digital work that's then going to be manipulated 5 or 10 times to produce something completely different again? You know, these are sort of in some ways new scenarios.
Well, yeah, and you look at YouTube, you know, it will identify copywritten music and then indicate that. So, you know, you're starting to get these kind of external checks and balances, which I think make us think. It's just, you know, how seriously do we take them? And at what point, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of education for all of us, I think, to have to do this better.
Yeah, and in some ways, this is an education that the whole society is going through as well.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really have, this hasn't settled down yet.
Oh my gosh, we're deep in the heart of it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I would ask you, you know, what do you think about, you know, there's discussion in the government here just about protecting kids from indiscretions, you know, postings or, you know, marking up their digital footprint until a certain age. Do you guys have anything like that, or is there any kind of discussion around those issues?
I don't know that there's discussion of sort of a certain age or whatever. I mean, the UK has a thing called the Data Protection Act, which is one of the most, as far as I know, one of the most stringent kind of regulatory frameworks in the world, or legal frameworks, in fact, around about who can, how your data can be used by companies and for what purposes and with what permission and so on. And I think that's certainly something, it's a topic that comes up a lot in conversation about using online resources and stuff as well. What is the relationship of, I don't know, like Google Apps to the Data Protection Act? Mm-hmm. And is this personal information and so on? And how is it going to be used and questions like that? There's not so much built around a specific age as the way it is in the US. I mean, I know it's framed as sort of 13 years old being the kind of age of maturity for that kind of stuff. In the UK, it's much more, you know, have you given permission to do this? And I don't know that I've heard too much about the question around, well, can a six-year-old give informed consent for their data to be used in a certain way? I haven't really heard a lot of that debate. It's more around that.
Yeah, and the tricky thing is, you know, like any smart employer or school is going to do some research on the people they're bringing in. Mm-hmm. And so there are all sorts of stupid things that you know, everybody does online. It's very, you know, it's very easy to slip up and kind of mark, or, you know, add a black mark to your digital footprint. So,
yeah,
you know, what does that mean? I guess I was talking to someone, I can't remember, about a month ago, and just saying, you know, is it the kind of personal and professional life for a younger generation is kind of blurring. Their kids are less concerned about creating kind of this dual life. Like, you know, I have my LinkedIn profile and I have my Facebook profile, and they're very different. You know, my Twitter presence is very different than, you know, it's not personal. I try not to make it, you know, it's more professional and that area. But for kids, I think for younger generations, that line is blurring. There's not necessarily any interest in dividing personal and professional. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think that's very much an evolving experience. You know, I think we're saying kind of coming to the middle age of the first generation of people who sort of use the internet intensely, you know, people of my age and a little bit older, you know, and I can personally sort of feel my interest in like posting a lot of stuff on the internet declining. You know, okay, I'm still on Twitter and I'm still blogging, but I don't want to also be on Facebook, which I'm not. Or, you know, I don't have to sign up for every new social network that comes out. And I don't kind of feel compelled to sort of put myself out there all the time anymore. And it'll be interesting to see with the next generation whether it's actually a different factor of their generation from our generation, or if it's just young people do that and middle-aged people don't. You know, and will they grow up to feel the same way that I feel now, or will they continue to live that different kind of lifestyle until they're 45 and 50 and so on?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I wonder, you know, I'm noticing that our students in middle school, you know, 5 through 8, 5, they use email. But the older the kids get, you know, by 8th grade, they're not really using email anymore. Mm. They're communicating in other ways. And that's hard to wrap my head around, because I felt like, well, email is the lowest common denominator. You know, and when we were looking at workflow options, we were thinking, okay, well, you know, well, email works, you know, is that, and we're not doing that. You know, I've taken that out of the equation, but it's just not, it's not their the primary tool that they use to communicate, which again, to me, you know, for our generation and certainly for our teachers, that's for the majority of teachers, that is the way they communicate.
Yeah. I think the challenge is sort of understanding the mindset. Isn't it? You and I are like, well, how can MD not use email? And then, like, my parents are, well, why doesn't everybody still make a phone call? You know.
Yeah.
But the older I get, the more I'm just like, I just want to go on the phone to somebody and get this sorted out right now. You know, I don't want to wait for another round of email. In some ways,
exactly,
the way I'm getting rid of email is by phoning people again. You know.
Yeah, I love that. And because, you know, I think about that too. You know, how many emails is it going to take to resolve this? You know, it would be much quicker on the phone. I say, you know, call me back, or, you know, set a time, because then there's the whole managing the calendar thing and the phone call. Like, now I got my calendar is full of phone calls, you know, and what's better? I don't know. Yeah. Like, all right, I got a phone call at 8:30. I got a phone call at 8:32. I don't know. There's got to be something better. I think Twitter, maybe. Twitter is maybe it.
I know, it's like we've kind of taken, like, we still want to have a phone call, but we want it to have the sort of etiquette of not disturbing you, like email, you know, so we now schedule our phone calls through email. Yeah.
And with phone calls, you got to be nice and stuff, right? You got to say, hey, how's it going? Like, you know, there's like a 2 minute, like a one, yeah, there's, you got the front loaded kind of niceties, and then there's kind of the dwindling out at the end, and I don't know, it's a lot of time. It's a lot of friendliness and social stuff.
Yeah, well, I suppose that is
overrated, I tell you. Yeah.
Maybe you can only see 140 words in your phone call.
That would be good. I like that. Maybe that's the next round of communications: voice 140 syllable phone messages or voice messages.
It's a phone service that cuts off after 2 minutes, regardless.
Yeah,
that, and then you have an hour of cool off period after you get off the phone. You can't call them back.
That's right. You got a buffer. You got like an hour long buffer. That's great. All right. I think we need to invent that. Let's see what happens. It's like Vine. What is Vine about, right? I mean, what is that 6 second loop? I mean, come on. What is that?
What can you do? Yeah.
What can you do with 6 seconds? I don't care how creative you can get. I mean, come on, really?
Well, see, if you upgrade to Instagram, you get a whole 15 seconds.
There you go.
Yeah.
I don't know. We're spiraling.
Yeah. Let me push on a little bit from this. Mention of Instagram just kind of jogged my memory there, because I was going to ask you, you know, how different are these things? You know, I always ask my kids every year, I say, like, well, what social networks are you guys on? And the class will say whatever they're on, you know, but it's been really interesting because I've noticed a decline in interest in Facebook. And actually, for school age people, I've seen much less interest in Twitter than I might have expected. Mm-hmm. But the two that stick out to me as ones that young people are spending a lot of time on are Instagram and YouTube. Mm-hmm. And they do regard YouTube as a social network in a way that I don't think about it that way.
Yeah. I absolutely Instagram is huge. I mean, it's really gained a ton of momentum. I mean, the kids are more interested in that than anything else, and we don't have any policies around Instagram or even really talk about it, so I have to figure out a way to talk about it, you know. But ideally, you know, if we're educating them well, you know, whatever the technology, there's, you know, the checks and balances in place and the thought process in place that could apply to anything, because you know, good citizenship is good citizenship. But I think, you know, about a year ago, I was kind of talking to some folks that were visiting and had the revelation that, you know, education and kind of our world has been so text-based, or actually not our world, but education, mm-hmm. right? And education around education, that's kind of been one of the big social pieces growing up. I mean, how much time do you spend in schools? A ton of time. Yeah. And a lot of it is based on language and writing and reading. You know, writing to show you understand, or writing to communicate, and reading to learn. So I think this move towards multimedia, images, video, is really tapping into something, one of the core things that makes us human. You know, it's how we experience the world in 1,000 other ways than just language, mm-hmm. right? Or written language. It's not surprising that kids are using video and imagery kind of to connect, to share what they see, to share their experiences. I mean, it's one thought, but I think it feels right. You know, we've been painting on caves for, you know, much more before this whole internet thing, and certainly the typewriter. So I think that's, you know, we're going back to what makes us human.
I remember Steve Jobs saying many years ago at some product launch or something, where he said that, like, I think it was maybe the first time iMovie was shown back in the early days, and he said, look, this is the way that young people are reading and writing now, is that they're doing it through video as well.
Yeah.
And I suppose the kind of visionary aspect of that was not just to launch a video editor product, but as much to see that the way that people communicate and experience and also learn now, as we see from YouTube as well, is also audio and video. You know, I mean, I was looking at some podcast production techniques before we got on the show today. And I mean, do you know where I was learning it from? YouTube.
YouTube, yeah.
Right? It wasn't even a blog, right? Because I looked up a blog and it was like, here's 45 steps to do this thing. And then it was like a 2.5 minute video on YouTube. And it's like, oh, I just watched the video. But I remember talking to teachers in school, and I said, look, just as an experiment, imagine I had to block one of Wikipedia or YouTube, which one would you keep? And every single teacher said YouTube. Nobody said Wikipedia. And to me, that was very interesting in terms of like how much usage teachers get out of the content that's on YouTube.
Yeah, and it's become my go-to too. You know, and it's funny. I think the shift for me was just recently. You know, I go on the internet all the time to find things that I need to know, and more I've been looking for that YouTube, you know, that YouTube result, and looking for the best tutorial. I think one of the revelations came to me was like, I think 7 years ago or something. I was working at another, or no, five, 4 or 5 years ago maybe. Had an intern at my last school, and he was getting ready for some formal occasion and had to tie a bow tie, and he looked, you know, he looked up on the YouTube, and I was like, what? Like, I never would have thought of that, and maybe I'm behind times, but I was like, wow, that makes so much sense. Yeah. Like, to be able to mirror, you know, and that to me, like, I'll never forget that, because it hit me like, oh my God, we can learn anything. I mean, we learn by doing. We learn by watching. Mm-hmm. We can play it over and over again. You can't even do that in real life, right? In the real world. So it's pretty amazing tool.
It certainly is. And I think the way we've just discussed it and the way we think about it is I think also a little different from the way that kids think about it, because, you know, one of the big things on YouTube I hear a lot about in school is people learning how to complete video games by watching videos of other people doing it on YouTube. And the way that kids talk to me about that, and they talked about like the sort of relationship they had with the people who are producing these videos, and oh yeah, he had this thing on his channel and he showed me how to do that, and then he put this in his channel and so on. And I kind of feel like I cherry pick from YouTube. I say, well, I come to YouTube through a Google search or something, and that looks like a good YouTube result. Whereas kids are sort of actually building relationships in YouTube in a way that I've never thought about it as a way to use YouTube. I use it as a kind of video library, and they use it as a way to communicate through videos. And I think that's a very interesting thing.
Yeah, oh, it's so interesting, and I think I watch my son. He's 12 years old now, and he's really interested in building and setting things on fire. Which as long as he finds the safe way to do it on YouTube, I'm okay with it. But there's some stupid people out there that are putting stuff on YouTube. So we talk about that. Like, that is not something to try at home. This is something to try at home. But yeah, it's a whole other world. It's funny. I was talking to a guy called what was his name? Don Wetrick today. Has a class he started called I think Innovation Classroom or something. But he talks about basically it's not a class on entrepreneurship. They kids have to choose a project, and then they are doing deep research, and they're communicating via Twitter and however else with experts in the field. And they are learning through doing that, kind of these social media channels and all of that. I guess I'm jumping back a little bit, just effective use of tools, that these are powerful communication tools. It's not something that when you're bored, you do stupid things with. They are powerful ways to connect with, experts in the field who are willing to have a conversation. And so he talks about it. He says, it's common. Don't be common. Common is, communicating badly or, wasting time with social media. You can use these tools to leverage and be amazing. And so I loved how he talked about that. And like you said, connecting with the world, connecting with people. And I think it feels like experts in the field are more and more accessible. That kids are having conversations with people they never would have before, who are brilliant in their field, and for kids to have access to that is empowering. So how do you help them, be better communicators so that they can have those professional relationships that will help them grow?
That's absolutely the challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what environment do you create to allow them to do that? And it requires they have to do it, right? This goes back to you block all those ways to communicate, and they never have a chance to develop those skills.
For sure.
So,
Yeah.
yeah.
And I think it also kind of feeds in a little bit to perhaps stretching out the design of the curriculum a little bit, because a lot of these interactions can't happen in a 1 hour slot, particularly when, like between you and I, time zones are an issue for a lot of experts. They're not all the experts in the world live in the UK. So.
I thought they're all in Scotland. I thought they were all in Scotland.
Oh, no. I couldn't possibly comment. Somewhere. But you have to sort of take a slightly longer view of some of these projects if you want to have people go out and ask for information and get it back and so on. That can't all happen in just 1 hour in the classroom.
No, you're right. It's not the traditional structure of our school, but I think all the things we're talking about are schools need to be redesigned in order to serve the kids.
That's a whole other show, isn't
That's a whole other
it?
show. That's a lifetime right there. That's a 10-part series of 4 hour. Yeah,
That's a career.
Many many seasons.
Yes. Season 7. It's longer than ER. Let me take another break, and we'll talk about our second sponsor just now. We'll have Bradley drop back in.
Hey, out of school listeners, Bradley here. I'll be back next week, but I wanted to take an opportunity to tell you about a new app that's sponsoring Out of School. It's called Silent Light. It's a silent ally for every teacher in managing classroom noise levels. Silent Light enables you to set noise level targets with your classroom and then reward the students for being focused. With illustrations based on a traffic light, Silent Light uses a subtle audio and visual cue to give learners feedback on the noise level and encourages them to manage their own volume. So there's you've got no more shushing. Let Silent Light help you focus on the business of teaching. You can find out more at Top Story Apps at topstoreyapps.com or search for Silent Light on the App Store. And we'll also have a link in the show notes at outofschool.net or in your favorite podcatching device. So again, that's Silent Night for the iPad. Silent Light at topstoreyapps.com. Thanks for sponsoring Out of School this week.
So last thing I wanted to just wrap up with, Don, was a kind of forward-looking question is, how do we pick up the next thing that's coming along the line? I mean, I remember a few years ago, I was getting all ready to write a sort of e-safety curriculum around about MySpace. And then MySpace just fell off a cliff. And I somewhat suspect that Facebook for the next generation might eventually go a similar way. And obviously new things like Instagram. I mean, Instagram was nowhere 2 years when I was thinking about, you know, MySpace and Facebook. Then Instagram comes along, and then Vine comes along, and then, you know, what comes next? You know, and how do we as schools sort of detect what is coming next?
Well, I think you've already predicted the 140-syllable phone message, so I think we can start writing curriculum for that.
Yeah, there's a new technology called the telephone. Be
that's
careful.
Right. We could, you know, so, you know, the way I see it is, you know, we don't teach specific media out there. I mean, you can mention them, you can refer to them, but I think that our responsibility is to teach kids responsibility. You know, how do you communicate well? How do you treat each other as well? We have to give them skills that they can transfer to, that they can generalize to whatever they encounter. There's no way we can keep up and keep building curriculum around specific social media. We just can't. I mean, it's, and I don't think it's a good use of our time. But we can talk about, you know, we have five senses, so we can talk about how we gather information and share information that way. And how do we do it with, you know, a system of checks and balances? How do we do it well? Like, how are we good people? And I can't see any other way to do it and do it well. What do you think?
I think one of the things that interests me a lot right now is things like Vine and Instagram they're kind of extensions of things that we've already had. You know, I mean, we had Flickr before, we had Facebook photos, so Instagram's it's still just like sharing photos with other people. But then there are these other things that are going to come along, and I think there's interesting challenges there. And the first one that we're kind of already getting into is location. That's a new media that we're sharing is positional information, possibly in real time as well. And then obviously you've got things like Google Glass coming along, which is a whole other thing again, where you know, with all of these previous like photo taking and sharing systems, there's always been that kind of social modality, if you like, that I've taken a picture, and it's always been kind of obvious that I did take a picture. But then there's this whole, you know, almost, you know, surveillance kind of aspect to that as well. And then the step beyond that, I think, is the sort of quantified self movement, where you're sharing you're collecting and then possibly sharing more and more personal data about yourself. You know, do we want our blood sugar levels posted on the internet for people to see? Do we want our genetics, 23andMe, for example?
Yeah.
Do we want our genetic makeup shared with everybody, and so on and so on and so on? You know, and I think the thing that kind of interests me is those steps. Not the kind of, you know, it's the same media, but we change the name of it. But when a whole new thing becomes shareable, and we have to start talking about the consequences of that. And I think that's the thing that, I mean, I find it hard to imagine the consequences of some of that stuff, and I'm sure teenagers do as well.
Yeah, I think with all kind of all your health tracking devices now, right? Your DigiFits and like you said, you know, medical information, you know, we'll be able to constantly track every heartbeat and blood sugar level, you know, 24 hours a day. So, you know, it goes back to the point I raised earlier, you know, is the next generation going to care? Like, is this whole idea of separating personal life and professional life really going to be even an issue anymore? You know, and I don't know. I mean, there's an indication that maybe that division is less important. And if that's the case, you're right. Where do you draw the line? I mean, do we just become completely transparent beings? And there's a point where there's so much information that what do you do with that unless you're really digging?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, so the more information you share, you sort of went, you choke the system by giving out too much information. But then,
well, yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, building a jungle, you know, around a pin. So
it's going to be interesting.
I don't know. It absolutely is. No, I'm so curious. I mean, I think it's a great question, and certainly Google Glass is a you know, introduces a whole nother level of data capture and information.
It does. I think one of the challenges for young people in some ways is also for us to interpret to them how older people see their behavior, right? So whereas there may be new norms appearing in their generation, the older generation who, let's face it, have both economic power and status and grant these young people access to all of those things by hiring them, by admitting them to universities, all of these things, they might not perceive this new behavior in as positive a light as the young people that are engaging in that behavior see it. And that is something I think is also a challenge for us.
It is. I mean, there's that. On the other hand, you look at Silicon Valley and you've got, you know, 25-year-olds ruling the world. So and they get that generation, right? So and they're looking for you know, qualities that may not be an older generation. So I think we're shifting, and so the concern that younger folks have to fit into the templates that we expect, I don't know if that's going to that's going to make as much of an impact as anything else. So
I think in the last 2 minutes of our conversation, we have just outlined the exact difference between Scotland and America, right there. You know, the old world.
Excellent.
And the new world.
There you go. Yeah. No, I think you're right.
So, Don, it's been fascinating talking over these topics, and I'm sure this conversation is not finished yet. It's something that's going to grow and grow as more of these, more data becomes shareable, new ways to share it, and new ways to capture it as well. I think these are really the three parts that I see kind of moving in around each other, if you like, you know. And I guess we just have to dance on the moving carpet as we go.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's so fascinating. And it's good to kind of sit back and think about it for a little bit, because it is, you know, a lot of time it's just trying to catch up and keep up. But to sit, reflect, and look, and, you know, and maybe have kids in the conversation sometimes too, because I think it's really hard for us to really understand their perspective without digging.
Well, like I said, that question that I ask every year, you know, what social networks are you on? There's nothing I can read on the internet that tells me anything better than just asking kids in front of me and saying, well, what are you into? What are people actually doing with it?
Yeah.
And they'll tell me both what they do, but also what they see other people doing as well. And in some ways, if you ask them about other people, it's easier to get information than asking them about themselves sometimes.
Exactly. I have this friend who has a friend.
People who are not me.
That's right. Everybody else. I would never do such a thing.
I heard of somebody one time.
That's good.
Fantastic. Don, I want to thank you for sitting in for Bradley for these couple of weeks. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Oh, no, it's wonderful. I love it, Fraser.
Do you want to let people know where they can find you online?
Sure, yeah. You can go to our school website, which is Hillbrook, HILLBROOK.org, or HillbrookILab.com, which talks about our learning spaces. And I am on Twitter at FindDonOrth.
Awesome. I'm Fraser Spears. I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter. Spears.org is my blog. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.